Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Matthew Rothschild, who's the editor of The Progressive magazine, which is published in Madison, Wisconsin. He's one of the leading voices for peace and social justice in this country and is the author of You Have No Rights, Stories of America in an Age of Repression. Welcome to Background Briefing, Matthew Rothschild.
Hey, Ian. Thanks for having me on.
And you have in your neighborhood, I guess, in Janesville, Wisconsin, the man of the moment, Paul Ryan. We've just learned that this blue-collar regular guy comes from a fairly wealthy family. He has worked for the government all his life. He's basically never been in the private sector, yet has managed to accrue a fortune of about $8 million. And he's, of course, he pales compared to his running mate, Mitt Romney. But in Wisconsin, do people buy it that he's just a regular guy? He's a kind of Joe the plumber.
Well, the thing is that Paul Ryan has a lot better people skills than his boss does, Mitt Romney, certainly. And he's able to do retail politics in a way that Mitt Romney doesn't. He relates to people well. He's there, you know, pressing the flesh and in the July 4th parade and the Labor Day parade, and everyone knows him in Janesville as their neighbor or the guy who shows up at church, etc. So it's not like he's lived his life, you know, behind a gate like the Romneys have, and it's not like he was born with that silver spoon in his mouth, though his family is doing quite well, as you suggest. But he's a good salesman. I mean, I think he's a snake oil salesman, but he's a better peddler of the myth of unbridled capitalism than Mitt Romney is, who just doesn't look the sympathetic part. Whereas you got Ryan there, and, you know, with his basset hound eyes and his, unshaven face, I mean, can't he find a razor that works or a tie? Did someone steal all his ties? I mean, the down-home costume does get a little ridiculous at some point. But, you know, I wouldn't sell the guy short. You know, he gets elected time and time again from Janesville, Wisconsin, 40 minutes from Madison, the same town that Russ Feingold, the great senator from Wisconsin, who got defeated 2 years ago, was from. My wife grew up in Janesville. I spent a lot of time in Janesville. It is a working-class town. It was a GM town, but GM shut down. It was the town of Parker Pen Manufacturing, these fancy pens, and that shut down. In fact, the manufacturing sector in Janesville and other towns in Ryan's district, that sector has been devastated, even as Paul Ryan has voted for one free trade agreement after another, which has shipped these jobs overseas.
So how would he compare to Scott Walker, who, as we all know, survived a recall? He comes, I think, from fairly modest background, more so, I think, than Ryan. What I find extraordinary about the Republicans is that they can be both the arsonists and the fire brigade. I mean, Ryan voted for TARP, which is what propelled the Tea Party into being, their outrage at Wall Street. He voted for the huge boondoggle, the prescription drugs benefit. But now he's out on the stump talking about how Obama's going to take away your Medicare when the opposite is true. It is so amazing. And I was just noticing your governor, he went to the Sikh temple the other day and put a thing over his head and went to the service for all of the Sikh worshippers who were murdered by a Nazi who was carrying a concealed handgun that is allowed in the state of Wisconsin thanks to Governor Scott Walker signing it into law.
Yeah, well, these guys are cut from the same cloth. You know, they are very good retail politicians who are peddling an agenda for the absolute super rich, both an economic agenda and a social agenda that divides working people one from another. After all, Scott Walker's motto was he was going to divide and conquer. That's what he told his biggest contributor, this roofer down in Beloit, Wisconsin, near Janesville, who was a billionaire and who said, when can we get to a right-to-work state? When can we really, give it to these trade unions and get rid of them? And he said, well, we're going to divide and conquer. And by that he meant we're going to divide the working class and from the middle class, and we're going to divide public sector workers from private sector workers. And he succeeded in doing that. And Paul Ryan is succeeding also in putting the wool over people's eyes here on this, on these economic questions. I mean, he sells himself as this, you know, economic genius, and a lot of the Republican pundits are saying he's the wisest mind that we have on economics. But, you know, he's the original, you know, one-eyed man in the kingdom of the blind here, because, after all, he blames Franklin Delano Roosevelt for deepening the Depression, when, in fact, Roosevelt brought unemployment down from 25% to 10%. And similarly, he says Obama's stimulus package didn't do any good in his first 2 years. Now, just about every economist you talk to, including John McCain's former top economist, has recognized that the Obama stimulus package, insufficient as it was, still created, you know, around 2.5 million jobs. So he talks a good game, Paul Ryan does, but when you examine it, there's not that much to it.
Well, that was again in his speech the other day. He said that Obama has created the biggest deficit in American history, and of course they're running on that idea that trying to appeal to the idea that somehow the national budget's the same as a household budget, and where the government is living beyond its means, and you hardworking Americans who are trying to live within your means are being undermined by a profligate government who's throwing away all this money on a bunch of undeserving parasites who don't work. You know, that's what the attack on Obama's allegedly trying to give states waivers on welfare requirements, which is a made up issue. But, you know, your point is that had Obama not had a stimulus, we'd be in the Great Depression, number two. This is what I find extraordinary. How in God's name do they keep getting away with such brazen behavior? Every ad that Romney's put out is an incredible lie, but nobody seems to call him on it.
Well, it's amazing what people will believe, ultimately. And if they're told it time and time again, you know, chances are they'll believe it all the more. And part of the problem is that President Obama has not defended the progressive agenda defiantly enough and strongly enough and clearly enough. For instance, even on the example that you mentioned about deficits, a national budget deficit being different from a household deficit, I've heard President Obama say on several occasions that the government needs to act just like a household, and we've got to balance our budgets and tighten our belts, and we can't, you know, let our children or grandchildren pick up the debt on their credit card or on the government's credit card and run up the bill for them. That would be immoral. So he sometimes sings from the Republican hymnal, and that's a real problem here. He also has offered, or did offer at one point, to engage in a grand bargain with John Boehner of the Republicans, a bargain about Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, the very issues that Paul Ryan runs on here, on these so-called entitlement issues. And even in the last couple months, the Obama campaign has said that it would be open to that grand bargain again in the second term. Well, if it's going to be open to cutting Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security, what is the real difference here between Obama and Romney Ryan? He needs to highlight the differences, not blur those differences up. And I'm just afraid that his rhetoric over time has been blurring the issues. Maybe he'll clarify them now that Romney has picked Ryan, and Obama may think he has an opening. But I sure hope he will. Otherwise, I fear that even if Romney and Ryan don't win the White House by raising these issues, they're going to be gaining ground ideologically. It'll be a winner for the Republican agenda and a winner for Wall Street, unless President Obama and Vice President Biden can really hammer Ryan into the ground by pointing out to people what he wants to do, which is nothing short of repealing the New Deal, repealing the Great Society, and returning us to a primitive capitalism.
But do you think that Obama and Biden can win this election by tearing the other guys down? Or, I mean, there was a poll, a focus group done by CNN that Amitai Etzioni told me about. He said where they asked all of the swing voters at present, what is the Republican narrative? And they could repeat it verbatim. They knew all the talking points the Republicans have. They said, what is the Democratic narrative? And nobody knew it. I mean, so I don't know what Obama and Biden are running on, do you?
Well, that is a real problem, that the Democrats now for a generation or two have not had a platform that makes people's lives better and that's ultimately comprehensible. Welfare, as we know it, Bill Clinton threw that over, and that was a bone to, you know, the white working class that is that can be, you know, seduced by pretty thinly veiled racist appeals, and that didn't help people across the board. The earned income tax credit maybe with Bill Clinton helped, but health care reform for Obama helped a lot of people, but he's had a hard time selling that because he's, I don't know, either been unable to or afraid to sell it. It shouldn't be hard to sell. If you've got pre-existing conditions or you've got a loved one with a terrible disease, don't you want to be covered? Don't you want your kid to be covered? And yet the Republicans don't have an answer for that. I would think that's a winning issue for him. I wish he'd come out for single payer or a public option and Medicare for all who want it. But again, he was pitching himself toward the middle at that point.
Again, I'm speaking with Matthew Rothschild, the editor of The Progressive magazine, published in Madison, Wisconsin. He's one of the leading voices for peace and social justice in the country and is the author of You Have No Rights, Stories of America in an Age of Repression. So do you think, you're in a college town there, Matthew, in Madison, Wisconsin, do you think that the youthful activism that showed up in 2008, that propelled Obama into the White House, and the Democrats, after all, picked up a substantial majority in the Senate, filibuster-proof majority in the Senate, a strong majority in the House. They had for 2 years. They had the trifecta. That's obviously nobody's thinking that that's ever going to happen in 2012, and most people think it's going to be awfully tight. Do you think that the 2008 youth vote will return?
No, it's going to be nowhere, and this is the problem for Obama. There's a ton of enthusiasm on the right to get rid of him, and yet the base that got him elected, the progressive base, the labor base, the youth vote, those forces that helped to elect him feel let down by him. Feel like he didn't deliver on the progressive agenda. He didn't really speak to or inspire young people until his late comments on the Dream Act and on gay marriage. But not enough. I mean, my daughter went door to door for Obama, and you know, she's pretty disgusted with him, and so are her friends. I mean, there isn't that movement to make history. It's also hard to make history twice. And people were inspired by Obama in part to make history, but also in part because, you know, he offered or suggested that he was offering something new and something bold, but he never defined what the new and the bold was, what the hope and the change was. And as a consequence, we haven't gotten a lot here. And people are not that excited about Obama this time around, excited enough to do the work that may be necessary to get him reelected. At this point, I still think he's going to get reelected, but there's not going to be that groundswell from young people, that's for sure.
And nobody thinks that that the Democrats are going to take back the House, or even they may even lose the Senate. So if he does get elected, presumably we'll have some serious gridlock, right?
Well, we'll have gridlock, and if we don't have gridlock, we may have disaster. And by that, I mean maybe Obama will compromise on Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, or maybe Obama will bomb Iran. I mean, wouldn't it be a disaster if the difference on the Iran issue between Romney and Obama is that Romney would bomb Iran in the first couple months in office, and Obama would wait 8 months to bomb Iran? Boy, if that's the only difference, we're in a world of hurt. Of course, there are other issues, like the Supreme Court, you know, women's right to choose, and gay rights, where the issues are quite stark. I mean, here we have a guy in Ryan, for instance, who doesn't believe in abortion, even in instances of rape or incest or the life of the mother. So that's as right wing as you can get. But on some of these other issues, if there's gridlock, I'm afraid that Obama and his tendency is to compromise will compromise too much.
Well, but I think wouldn't the opposite be true? That we were just discussing Matthew Rothschild about what is the Democratic narrative? They don't have one. The best narrative they have is that I'm not the wrecking crew that's going to turn America over, to the oligarchs and corporate. You know, we'll have a corporate CEO running America. We'll have more John Roberts and Alitos on the court. We'll get rid of Roe v. Wade. I mean, it's pretty clear that there's going to be an aggressive right-wing agenda enacted if they get the White House. What's your assumption that he would want to compromise with the wrecking crew?
That's just because I've looked at how he's governed over the last 4 years and listened to his rhetoric, and his bargaining position is always to give away the most principled position he has before the bargaining has begun. Right. And then if they're in gridlock, I mean, to get anything accomplished, he's going to feel that he has to bend even more to the other side. So that's a problem. But you're right, Ian. I mean, this is a very aggressive ideological attack from the Republican right wing that we see with this Ryan choice. And it needs to be hit head on. It can't be, you know, I agree with you part of the way. And I don't know why Obama keeps praising Ryan as a serious person and a decent man and a great family man. I mean, is he going to take the gloves off or not?
Well, that's what I was getting at, Matthew. It seems to me that the only argument that to vote for Obama is the old, unfortunately, the argument why people vote for the Democrats, particularly with the Supreme Court, is to hold the line against a complete kind of lurch into medievalism. You know, we already have our economy has largely become a plutonomy. Our game show democracy is largely being captured by the oligarchs. So if they get the court and they get all their social issues involved, then this is going to be a very strange and uncomfortable country to live in.
Well, the oligarchs are going to win either way. I mean, I think we should face that. But the question is whether on social issues, whether this country will turn rabidly to the right as it would under Romney and Ryan. But certainly, you know, Obama hasn't hurt Wall Street terribly, and they still pretty much run the show. Wall Street and the Pentagon run Washington, and Obama hasn't been strong enough to defy them.
Well, yeah, and this time around, they gave him a ton of money in 2008, and now they're giving it all to Romney. So if he doesn't decide who his friends are and who his enemies are, I think we're all in trouble.
Well, we are in trouble, and we're in trouble until we get money out of politics, until we overturn the Citizens United Supreme Court case and amend the Constitution that says money is not speech. And corporations are not persons, and affirms the right of the government to regulate campaign contributions and expenditures. Otherwise, you know, we're living in a plutocracy right now.
Well, do you think that that is an adequate kind of rallying cry? I mean, in the Vietnam War, of course, people had skin in the game in the sense that the younger generation were being drafted. Do you think you can build a countervailing movement against the oligarchy? I mean, at a cultural level, it's done. I don't know whether you've seen the movie that's out now with Will Ferrell, but it really does, you know, at a cultural level, make it extremely clear what's happening to this country. But at the political level, you've got the Occupy movement that basically says a plague on all your houses. We don't, you know, we hate the Democrats as much as the Republicans. They do talk about campaign finance being a central issue. How do you build a political movement around these sort of issues as opposed to, some kind of manifesto?
Well, I think it's important to build the mass movement for the issue and not for the political candidate. And I think on this issue of amending the Constitution to overturn the Supreme Court decision, Citizens United, I think that's a popular issue. A vast majority of Americans understood that allowing corporations and the wealthiest Americans to give unlimited amounts in campaign advertising was somehow taking our voice away. This isn't the democracy of one person, one vote. You know, this is, you know, if you've got $1 million, you got to, you know, you can spend all that money and run ads every night. Who among us as citizens can run ads every night for a candidate of our choice. That's not a democracy at this point. And so I think this move to amend the Constitution is gathering steam. There is a grassroots movement for it in cities and states across the country. People are passing referendums in favor of amending the Constitution. And I think really fundamentally, that's what it's going to take. You know, once Election Day is over, we got to get serious and amend the U.S. Constitution to take money out of politics finally.
Well, Matthew Rothschild, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
My pleasure, Ian. Anytime.
Again, I've been speaking with Matthew Rothschild, who's the editor of The Progressive magazine, published in Madison, Wisconsin. He's one of the leading voices for peace and social justice in this country, and he's the author of You Have No Rights, Stories of America in an Age of Repression. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with Todd Gitlin about his new book, Letters to a Young Activist.